Welcome to the Nerd Party.
Let the filibustering begin.
Welcome to Nerd Party.
Hello and welcome to Filibuster here in the Nerd Party Network. This week, I'm joined by author, filmmaker, and Academy Award nominee Nicholas Meyer to discuss his new Sherlock Holmes book, The Adventures of the Peculiar Protocols, which is available now. Me and Nicholas discuss his long history with The Great Detective, the Star Trek franchise, The Day After, James Bond, and much, much more in this interview special. Thanks so much to Nicholas for joining me. This was a real bucket list interview for me, and I hope you too will enjoy this episode. So I'm recording this interview in Edinburgh, 1 mile from the birthplace of Sherlock Holmes author Arthur Conan Doyle, and a statue of the great detective himself. It's a huge privilege for me to be joined by a filmmaker and author who is synonymous with Holmes today. From Los Angeles, it's Nicholas Meyer. Welcome to the show, Nicholas.
Oh, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Before we kind of dive into sort of your latest book, I'd love to know about how your connection with Sherlock Holmes started.
When I was about 11 years old, at a very impressionable age, my father gave me the complete Sherlock Holmes stories to read. There are 60 stories, 56 short ones, and 4 novellas. And I was, as I recall, enchanted and gobbled them all up over a period of, I don't know, a couple of months. I'm not a fast reader, but I read them all. And I was very sorry when they ended, which is probably how I joined the ranks of people who write continuations. It's like those Star Trek fans who keep on making their own episodes. You know, you just want more.
What was the road from this passion for Holmes to the writing and publication of your first Holmes book, the wonderful 7% Solution?
Well, it's very involved. My father was a psychoanalyst, and when I was in high school, people said, "Oh, your old man's a shrink. Is he a Freudian?" And I didn't know. So I said, "Pop, are you a Freudian?" And he said, "Well, it's kind of a silly question." And I said, "Really? Why? Why is it silly?" And he said, "Because it's no more possible to discuss the history of psychoanalysis and not start, at least, with Sigmund Freud than it is to discuss, for example, the discovery of North America and not start with the Vikings or Columbus, take your pick, but to suppose that nothing has happened since Columbus is to be pretty rigid, pretty doctrinaire." And he went on to say, "When a patient comes to see me, I listen to what they say. I listen to how they say it. I am especially interested in what they do not say. I'm curious, are they on time? What kind of clothes they're wearing? What their body language is? I am, in short, searching for clues from them as to why they are not happy." And I thought, "Oh, gee, that sounds like detective work, what you do." And he said, "Yes, I suppose in a way it is like detective work." And that's when I realized who Sherlock Holmes always reminded me of, my dad. And so then I started to think, well, I just wonder how much Arthur Conan Doyle knew about the life and writing of Sigmund Freud. The first thing you realize is they're both doctors. Oh, yes. And they both died in the same town. Oh, yes. Within 9 years of each other. Then you remember that Sherlock Holmes is a cocaine addict. And Freud was, for a time, a cocaine user. And then you remember, or you learn, because all of this happened over a period of years, that Freud became interested in cocaine in the company of 2 eye doctors, Koenigstein and Koehler, on the use of cocaine as an anesthetic during eye surgery. And then you learn that Arthur Conan Doyle studied ophthalmology in Vienna. And so these, it's like Chinese water torture, these little tidbits of information keep descending. And over a period of years, and it was 15 years, I eventually wound up concocting Sherlock Holmes meets Sigmund Freud. Other people, by the way, have noticed the resemblance between Holmes and Freud, including Sigmund Freud, who wrote in one case history, quote, "I followed the labyrinth of her mind, Sherlock Holmes-like, until it led me to," I don't remember the rest of the sentence, but I thought, okay, even he got the resemblance. And somehow, you know, like tumblers falling into place or fiddling with a Rubik's Cube for 15 years, I came up with the 7% solution.
Was it an interesting period for being a writer of Holmes in the 70s? Can't imagine sort of how kind of almost perhaps maybe niche or less kind of, you know, expanded upon sort of story it was at the time, whereas in the past decade we have TV shows, Sherlock Holmes in America, you know, Sherlock Holmes miniseries, movie franchises, books on top of that.
Yeah, I started something.
Yeah, what was it like in the 70s as to for writing Sherlock Holmes? Was there much of an audience for it at the time, or was it more of a niche thing?
It was a niche thing. I am not the first person by any means to have written Sherlock Holmes pastiches that are not Doyle. This started almost immediately in the 20th century. Monsignor Knox or Ronald Knox or something started writing imitation Holmes. There were Holmes movies from the get-go, silent movies. There was a play starring this American, William Gillette, who became the very first famous Holmes. He got Doyle's permission to make a play about Sherlock Holmes, and he telegrammed Arthur Conan Doyle, "Is it okay if I marry Holmes?" And Doyle wrote back, "You can marry him or murder him or do what you like with him." And he made a career out of this, and he was in a silent movie about Holmes, which has recently been discovered. There are probably close to 300 movies or television shows about Sherlock Holmes, of which probably a good 150 have been lost. They were on nitrate stock, or they've otherwise disappeared. Having said all that, and there was the Basil Rathbone, Nigel Bruce, you know, stuff which I could never stand. And various, as I say, other imitations. But in 1972 or 73, when I was writing the 7% solution, I sort of had the field to myself, with one exception. And that is that around the time the book came out, the Royal Shakespeare Company revived that production of Sherlock Holmes, the William Gillette production. So we sort of fed each other. It was a sort of cross-fertilization of publicity and interest. The Gillette production, by the way, the play, did some things that changed Holmes in the public eye that Conan Doyle never did. For example, in none of Doyle's stories and in none of Sidney Paget's original illustrations of Sherlock Holmes did he ever use a curved pipe. That's not in the writings at all. But when William Gillette played Sherlock Holmes, he found it very difficult to speak dialogue while clenching a straight pipe in his mouth. But by taking a lower pipe, a curved pipe, he lowered the center of gravity that enabled him to speak. And then Frederick Dorr Steele, who was the first American illustrator of Holmes, picked Gillette as, understandably, as his model. And because of that, we have the curved pipe, the calabash, and you know, the also the deerstalker was, I think, Sidney Paget's illustration. I don't think, you know, he Doyle just mentioned a sort of a ear-flapped traveling cap, and that was it.
The one thing I love about your Holmes books, and you see it in the from the first one on, is that you are an editor of these lost manuscripts of Holmes characters. And I often think of it when I visited the 10 Baker Street, the museum there. And I always wonder how much responsibility you bear for this. This wonderful book of letters that people have written in to Dear Sherlock Holmes.
Oh, amazing.
You know,
letters to Sherlock Holmes.
Yeah, yeah. I always wonder how much of your book had to play with that.
A lot of people that I have met since I wrote the book as a kid were under the impression that Sherlock Holmes was a real person. And 221 Baker Street, which were formerly the address of the Abbey National Building Society, way before, I think, the 7% solution was written, but certainly after, that's 1974, were obliged to hire two full-time secretaries simply to answer letters addressed to their offices asking for questions or help from Sherlock Holmes, and they always had to say, Mr. Holmes is out of town and he'll get back to you as soon as possible, or whatever the rationale was for the fact that he couldn't answer any letters. I think the Building Society address isn't, they're not there anymore. I don't know what is.
One thing I'm curious about as well, that you are not just an author of Sherlock Holmes, you're an adapter of screenplays, to, you know, bringing it to the big screen as well. What was it like bringing the 7% solution to the big screen and then to be rewarded with an Academy Award nomination for that too?
Well, it was very pleasant, I can tell you. Everybody likes to be, to get a prize, or even to be, in my case, nominated for the prize. It was in, I made it a condition when they wanted to buy the book that I had to write the screenplay. I didn't want to entrust it to anybody else, even though I wasn't that experienced. I was in the movie business. I was writing movies, but and adapting something else, a novel or a short story, whatever it is, that's a process, and you can't just simply hit a button and it comes out. And there were a few things that I had to learn. One was to be ruthless. To movies and books are not the same. A book can be 1,000 pages long. It can be written in the first person. It can be written in the third person. It can wander all over the place. There can be subplots. A novel is not the same thing as a drama. A drama has a finite, you know, sort of time frame, and like a shark, it has to keep moving. It can't just go off and digress. Now that we have streaming and attenuated stories that can sort of go on forever, you can actually, sure, do the Odyssey. Why not? But even every episode of whatever it is, whether it's Mad Men or Homer, it has to keep moving. And so I had to do a lot of cutting, a lot of trimming. And the other thing I chose to do was to change the mystery that they solve. Because everybody who had read the book, and there were 2 million copies in print by then, already knew the mystery. There was a novel by a guy named Scott Turow, called Presumed Innocent. Very good book. And then they made the movie. And they just copied the mystery. So I went to see the movie, and I knew that the wife did it. Sorry for the people who haven't read Presumed Innocent. But yes. And I saw the movie and I thought, well, that's a shame. Because, you know, because I read the book, it was a spoiler. So I thought, because I didn't think the mystery in the novel was the greatest thing. The great thing in the novel was Sherlock Holmes meets Sigmund Freud. And then what happened? Well, that was up for grabs. So I changed it just to try to, you know, take people off guard so you couldn't just sit back and, you know, fall asleep over your bag of popcorn. You would say, hey, wait, what's going on? So those were the principal features of my adaptation, was cutting things out and changing the mystery. The other thing is that when I became a film director, when I started doing Time After Time and the Star Trek movies, I became a better screenwriter than I was before I had directed anything. And Time After Time, I would argue, is a much better screenplay than The 7% Solution, even though that's the one where I got my nomination. Because the ratio of between words and pictures, I should have cut a lot more than I cut. And it would have been just as good. It might have been even been better. There's a lot of talk in that movie. It happens to be good talk. It's smart talk. But there's a lot of it. And after I had directed Time After Time, I thought, gee, I could have done without a lot of the words. Had the same effect.
You've recently returned back to Sherlock Holmes with The Adventures of the Peculiar Protocols. What's brought you back for your first time to the Holmes novels? This is obviously your first Holmes story since 1993. Has this been one of many ideas that's been floating around in your head in those kind of past decades, or was this always the one that you wanted to bring to life?
Well, I don't write Sherlock Holmes stories unless I get an idea for a Sherlock Holmes story. Simple as that. I have always been interested in forgery. I am a forger, after all. I forge Sherlock Holmes manuscripts that are presumably written by either Watson or Arthur Conan Doyle. Take your pick. I'm a forger. And forgery is an interesting topic to me. It poses philosophical, moral, financial, economic, aesthetic questions. I'll give you a couple of examples. If you have two paintings and one was, and you can't tell the difference between the two paintings, that's the given. One was painted by Leonardo da Vinci and the other was painted by me. But if you can't tell the difference by any technical or technological means, then what is the difference? Why is one worth millions and the other worth, you know, $20, if that? The best answer I ever heard to that question is that one could not have existed without the other. What's the difference between a forgery and a copy? Something you can't see. The intention. So forgery interests me a lot. And when you start collecting literature and books about forgery, it isn't long before you encounter the biggest, baddest, most destructive forgery ever created. And that is something called the Protocols of the Learned Elders of Zion, which is about a Jew plot to take over the world. It was created in 1903 by the Okhrana, the secret police, Tsar Nicholas II, to justify the pogroms, the massacres of Jews in Russia, in Tsarist Russia. And no matter how many times the Protocols of the Learned Elders of Zion have been exposed as not only a hoax, but a kind of a clumsy hoax, not even a good one, they persist. They're in the Middle East. They're used as textbooks. It's a hoax that refuses to die. And all the newspaper articles and all the books that expose them have never really made a dent. And I thought, maybe I should try fiction. And the other thing that's happened is that in this country, we have a president who's a pretty big hoaxer himself. Every word that comes out of his mouth is a lie, including and the. And we have something called fake news. And he accuses everybody of what he does. So I thought, if it takes a thief, if you set a thief to catch a thief, maybe you should try getting a forger to go after a forgery. And that was sort of how the adventure of the peculiar protocols came into my head. And I thought about it for a good 10 years. I started writing it way before Trump. I just happened to catch the wave.
What's your process for writing and stuff? How do you go around developing the story, the plot, how it's going to be? What I like about your work is it ties in, you know, it felt very contemporary, draws a lot of parallels between the current political climate. How do you go around developing this until it's ready for the publisher?
It's very hard, and writers are always supplying sort of clever anecdotes about how they create, and I'm sure this would go for painters and filmmakers and all kind of artists. It's a mysterious process, what creativity, and it's different for everybody. Just the same way I suspect that everybody falls asleep differently. Somebody lies on their back, somebody does a face plant and a pillow, somebody wears a sleep mask, some people have sounds going on, and the same thing with writing. Sometimes people, you know, have music going while they're writing. I couldn't possibly, but you go about it in your own way, the same way you go about falling asleep, which is a sort of a letting go process in which you're unconscious mind comes out to play. Some people use an outline. Some people sort of make it up as they go along. There are two, as near as I can figure out, principal creative methods. We'll call it the Mozart method and the Beethoven method. Mozart did it in his head. Mozart liked to shoot pool. He was a good pool player. And he said that writing music was like peeing. It was just this natural thing. And when he wrote it down, he was literally copying what he had worked out in his head. There are very few corrections in a Mozart manuscript. It's just, boom, there it is. Whereas, when you look at a Beethoven manuscript, you see the whole process externalized ad nauseum. It just looks like the demented scratchings of a chicken on the staff paper. There are the notebooks. You can see it. Trial and error. No, not this, this, this. He had to sort of fumfer his way through it. I'm some kind of midway between those two extremes. I make notes. I have little notebooks. They look like this. I don't know if you can see it. Yes.
It's wonderful.
And I walk around and I, you know, it says, pick up laundry. And then you walk to another place and there's a line of dialogue on it. So it doesn't really sort of matter. I just go take these walks and then I take naps, and when I'm lying down from my nap or waking up from my nap is when these sort of ideas start falling into place. I don't know where they come from. But I can tell you that I am old enough to remember before computers. And before computers, writing was a lot more difficult. because the business of writing is rewriting. And when rewriting consists of having to get out the scissors and the scotch tape, you see all this stuff, and the whiteout, right? Show and tell. That discourages people who, like me, are not by nature perfectionists. I would say, oh, fuck it, let it go. I don't care about that comma. But you should care about the comma. And, you know, you may decide somewhere in the process that page 33 should really be page 64. If you have a computer, it's easy. You can be a perfectionist. You can cut and paste to your heart's content until you get it as good as you know how. And so, you know, Beethoven would have had a slightly easier time. One assumes that this would be a good thing.
What was it? Did it feel like stepping back into the world of Holmes and that character? Did it take some time to kind of get back into that groove, or did it feel like getting back into a pair of comfortable slippers?
A bit of both, I suspect. I love Victorian and Edwardian prose, whether I'm talking about Dickens on one end, or George Eliot, or H. Rider Haggard, Robert Louis Stevenson, Anthony Hope, John Buchan, even sort of Fitzgerald, Evelyn Waugh. I like that English. And it's not all the same. There are certain differences, but there is also a certain overall ambiance about that prose that is very appealing to me. So on the one hand, yes, comfortable slippers. I just like the way that stuff sounds. It is also true that forgers and forgeries have a certain built-in problem, and it works like this. All works of art, whether they're pieces of music or painting or literature, are all inevitably and ineluctably products of the time in which they were created. In other words, Mozart doesn't just sound like Mozart. He also sounds like late 18th century Middle European music. Renoir is not just inimitably Renoir. He is also late 19th century French Impressionism. That's fine that art sound, you know, all art, you can look at a piece of art, piece of music, and you can identify it. This piece of rock and roll is 1980s, right? You can look at a movie and say, ah, yes, this is black and white. It's silent, or this is, you know, foreign, or whatever. This is handheld. You can tell. That's fine. That's as it should be. But it sure plays hell with forgery, because forgery also is inevitably the product of the time in which it was created. And so, at the time, you may buy it. You may say, wow, this just reads like Conan Doyle. That's when it comes out. But 30 years later, it's not going to read like Conan Doyle. It's going to read like you. It's always the product of the time in which it was created. The Adventure of the Peculiar Protocols was written in the Trump era, and it is about fake news. And I can try my best to imitate Doyle, but at the end of the day, it's Doyle distilled by another writer in another time in another place. Some are more successful, but inevitably, inevitably, you look back and you say, oh yes, this was done, you know, in the whatevers.
One thing I always enjoy about your work, from Holmes to Star Trek, is the tying into the world of history, literary references, historical figures. What appeals to you as an author about this way of writing? For me, as a viewer, a listener, it's always kind of provided me as a gateway drug, really, through your work to more pieces of work and understanding history and so on. It's been really exciting whenever a new book of yours comes out or a new film or show, is to what am I going to learn about our world or this historical figure from your work? What is it about you that appeals to you as a writer about this way of writing?
I think that's a terrific question. I think it's a terrific question. I like to read. I like to watch movies. I like to listen to music. And I have, at least so far, a prodigious memory. And I like connecting the dots. I am fascinated by what was going on when this was happening, when that was happening, and so forth. Once you start, for example, reading the Doyle Sherlock Holmes stories, the originals, you look at where they are taking place and where they are alleged to be taking place, or approximately, and if you read a lot of history, and you read a lot of biography, and I read a lot of history and biography. I like to read that. And you learn about things that are happening more or less simultaneously. And I suppose a little while ago I was explaining or trying to explain where the 7% solution came from. Conversations with my father, learning about Sigmund Freud, then realizing that he and Doyle were contemporaries. So as you sort of learn these things, these sort of constellations of dots are forming in your brain, I guess, and the urge to connect these dots is pretty prodigious. I'll give you another example, which may or may not be relevant or interesting, but when I was doing Star Trek VI, I had been working on the character of Spock for some time. I did it in The Wrath of Khan. I did it in The Voyage Home. You know, I'm writing this character. And who does this character remind me of? Well, it's not a big stretch. He reminds me of Sherlock. And therefore, in Star Trek VI, in a rather offhand remark, he claims descent from Sherlock. This is connecting dots for the fun of it, I guess you would say. Michael Chabon, a writer I greatly admire, who's also now working on Star Trek, Discovery. But he said, all fiction is fan fiction. We're all adding to what has come before. The entire history of art, any kind of art, is the history of cut and paste. And as I noted before, computers make cutting and pasting a lot easier than it used to be.
Was one thing I was could always tell you is how important your books and films were to my understanding. I'm someone that, you know, I studied history. I was quite passionate about it. And elements of that, I think, came from, you know, you talk about computers. I would remember when, say, for example, my grandmother would get me the Star Trek VI VHS. And, you know, I was a young boy living in Scotland. And there's lines like, only Nixon could go to China. And I'm like, I don't know what that means. And being able to pull out like a thesaurus or a dictionary or the old Encarta CD-ROM and looking up what did that reference mean and expanding kind of my worldview, and your writing and your work has been that gateway to, you know, better understanding kind of world and history. And I've always enjoyed how franchises like Sherlock Holmes and Trek, which is our, their own thing out there in the world, get tied down into our own history, and you can see a connective tissue. It feels one and the same. I think that's something you've always done very well.
After the Second World War, the United States and a good deal of the West refused to acknowledge that China existed. It was this communist monolith entity. We didn't have diplomatic relations with them. We didn't recognize them. And in this anti-communist witch-hunting era in the 50s in America, where they were finding communists under every bed, whatever that meant, why they were under the bed, I'll never know. If a conservative Republican, or let's put it this way, if any Democrat who was not any kind of communist, but merely a Democrat, had proposed recognizing Red China, as we call it, Red China, they would have been burned at the stake. It was only because a conservative Republican decided to go to China, that somehow made it okay. Only Nixon could go to China. Bizarre, but
yeah. It was all those little references, and they were peppered throughout your work that I always enjoyed, whether it was from the Cuban Missile Crisis to those kind of lines were always appreciated. And I suppose I was kind of reflecting it when I got to the end of your book and had realised the gap between sort of your Sherlock Holmes novels, that it's very similar to probably your association with Star Trek in a way that, you know, that's by a span, the 80s into the early 90s, and then you have this huge gap, and then recently you become involved with it again, your work on Discovery Season 1, there's talk of, you know, miniseries, all these sorts of things. And I was interested thinking that when you got involved with Star Trek and Sherlock Holmes, it was this niche thing, there was one of it. And now that it's something where it's both are sprawling franchises with so many different interpretations, what was it like? Was it similar to Sherlock Holmes where you came back to this franchise, you know, after several decades out, almost very close to the dates, into something that had kind of changed and grown over time?
Well, that's a very interesting question. There's no doubt that Sherlock and Star Trek, which have proliferated, everybody doing versions of it, official versions, unofficial, all kinds, have sort of, there's a glut of it. And whereas Sherlock Holmes pastiches existed before the 7% solution, as I was saying when I wrote that book, there was not a lot of competition out there. It was, what did you say, sort of peripheral, niche was the word you used. And now it's, you know, it's just a big time industry in the same way that Star Trek is an industry. You know, and I sort of don't know what to say or what to make of that proliferation. I can tell you from a practical point of view, I don't necessarily relish being in competition with all of this. Some of it is very good. Some of it is terrible. I think it's safe to say that I almost couldn't stand any Sherlock Holmes movie growing up. I hated that Basil Rathbone stuff because I could never understand why a genius hangs out with a buffoon. I didn't understand that Watson is not supposed to be a dummy the way I read it. He's supposed to be average. He's supposed to be like a regular person, not a jerk. And I just didn't think Nigel Bruce sound. I didn't understand why does a genius want to hang out with that guy? So a lot of the Holmes pastiches, which in one form or another didn't take Doyle's originals as seriously as the 11-year-old boy I was did when I read it. It was all real to me. I didn't want it to be camp. I wanted it straight. And the other thing, you know, he was a cocaine addict. And the fact that people tried to pretend or get away from this, I thought, was a mistake and a misunderstanding. A lot of people who were big Sherlock Holmes fans in 1974 were very angry with the 7% solution, because that's the amount of cocaine he is injecting into his arms. And I said, you know, your problem, in my opinion, is that you're confusing heroes with gods. If a man leaps into a raging torrent to save a drowning child, we can agree that he performs a heroic act. But if the same man were to leap into the same river to save the same kid, and did it with a ball and chain attached to his leg, is he a greater hero or a lesser hero? And I would argue that if you got a ball and chain attached to you and you're doing it anyway, you're a much greater hero. And that Holmes's addiction, so far from diminishing his heroic stature, could actually be argued to enhance it, since he is functioning, you know, despite this ball and chain. And I think eventually, you know, people started becoming not quite so defensive about it, as though I had toppled an idol. I did not give him his addiction. Doyle gave him his addiction. I just, you know, built on it. By the same token, Doyle depicts him as a violinist. Now, I come from a family of musicians, and I love music, and I know something about it. So for me, that throwaway aspect of Holmes, the violin, in my book always gets made into something slightly more, simply because of my own enthusiasm and, you know, what kind of peripheral knowledge I bring to it. So I'm building on it, you know, but no one ever, you know, trashes me for having made Holmes a good violinist.
What was your experience like working on Star Trek Discovery? It seemed like a very interesting kind of place to work, you know, a franchise that has been kind of was dormant for quite a while, especially for television. What was it like to be there with sort of the sleeves rolled up, bringing something like that back to television?
Well, the biggest mystery to me was working in a writer's room with a bunch of other writers. I had done this a little bit before. I co-created a television series called The Medici, Masters of Florence, and I was in a writer's room doing that. And another show that I worked on was called Crossing Lines, and working in a writer's room and being part of a team and discovering that indeed it was possible to write scripts this way, and they would not necessarily be bad scripts either. But it was something I was very unused to, and had, I don't think, a lot of temperamental tolerance or ability for. I'm so used to sort of being my own master that, you know, sort of wanting to go off in a different direction and realizing you can't, you have to be part of the team, was a discipline that had to be mastered. And I do think it's important to master new things, to try new things, to put yourself in a kind of danger. I don't necessarily mean, you know, shaking hands with somebody who's got, you know, the coronavirus, but putting yourself creatively in places that are not congenial, that are not comfortable, that are not familiar, is probably good for you. Probably good exercise.
When I was watching it, the one thing I took away that I think it was maybe the third episode or something, when Alice in Wonderland was integrated into the show and through the first season, and I thought, I wonder if that was Nicholas Meyer, based on what we touched on earlier, that integration of your characters and plots with literary references and kind of developments. Would I be kind of correct in that assumption?
To be honest, I can't remember. I wouldn't be surprised if at some point I mentioned Alice in Wonderland, but I may not have been the first or the only person to have done it. I think one of the things that happened since my Star Trek movies, and perhaps also my Holmes novels, is that there's a much greater interest or respectability in doing that sort of thing. I think my interest in an enthusiasm for Herman Melville, for William Shakespeare, I don't know if you know who that is, but yeah. Anyway, those kinds of people, they write the best dialogue, and it's free.
One thing I was curious about as well is, I'm sure that you can't say a word, but there seems to be constant murmurs about this sort of Cannes miniseries. Is that something that is just kind of, you know, your mouth is kind of bound at the moment, or is that something we can maybe look to in the future, or is it behind you at this moment?
Well, I wrote it. I was hired to write it, a three-part episode. Or three hours. And I don't know what's become of it. I'm not really part of the Star Trek universe at the moment. I think when I originally wrote it, they thought three episodes would be fine. And then by the time I finished the three episodes, they said, oh no, really, it needs to be much longer, because that's all the rage now, are these sort of multi, you know, things. And I said, well, fine, I can do that. But we never got to it, and I'm not sure why.
If I don't ask you this question, it's been something that I've always been curious about for years. I've just turned 33, and the first real blockbuster of my kind of early teenage years was James Bond's Tomorrow Never Dies, and it's a film I have a huge lot of affection for and nostalgia for. And a few years ago, I stumbled upon the fact that you had sort of been an uncredited screenwriter on that. And I've always been curious about how Nicholas Meyer ended up involved in James Bond, and how I could never find any insight into how that happened or your kind of history with it. How did that kind of happen?
Two reasons. One is that my brother-in-law, Roger Spottiswood, directed the movie. And the other is that my friend, Pierce Brosnan, whom I directed in a movie called The Deceivers, a rather good movie if I say so myself, was starring as James Bond. And they were in London. I don't know where Pierce was at the time, but Roger was in London. And I got a call from another friend of mine, whose name is Jeff Kleeman, K-L-E-E-M-A-N. And Jeff, who was something of a protege of mine, I met him in 1985 when he was head of the Film Society at Yale, and I went there to speak. And then he came to Hollywood, and he became an executive. And then he was an executive at United Artists, and then they were making this James Bond movie, which my brother-in-law was directing, my friend was starring in, and I get a call. Can you come to London? And they were asking a bunch of writers to come to London, to a kind of a writer's room, you might say, but for a feature film. And I said, sure, what's going on? And they said, well, we want to know, what does the villain want? And remember, T two things. One, he has already wanted the golden Fort Knox, control of the oceans, the atom bomb, and outer space, among other things. And two, keep it simple. So, they flew me to London, and you have smart days and you have stupid days, and I don't know why, but I had a smart day, and I walked into this room. There were like 30 people just off Piccadilly at the Eon offices, and I said, okay, here's what you have to understand to get my idea. James Bond movies in many ways adhere to the rigid formality that is akin to that of an English sonnet. It starts off with a huge stunt, amazing stunt, which is followed by amazing title sequence, which is followed by Bond shows up and banters with Moneypenny before he goes to see M. M gives him the assignment. And then there's action sequence, action sequence, action sequence, and finally Bond meets Mr. Big in his lair or something. At which point Mr. Big says, no, Mr. Bond, it's not about the money, it's about... So imagine, I says, imagine that all that has happened. We've had the stunt, we've had the title sequence, we've had the banter with Moneypenny, the assignment from M, we've had action sequence, and now we meet Mr. Big. And he says, you know, Mr. Bond, I think that when you really get to know me, you'll discover that fundamentally, I'm a people person. There's too many of them. And he pushes a button, and on his screens all comes up every image of overpopulation. Traffic jams in Los Angeles, starving millions in Ethiopia or in Syria, wherever. And he says, even lemmings, Mr. Bond, even lemmings know what to do when they become too numerous. I am willing to bite the bullet on a problem that no politician will even address. Tell me, 007, that's some kind of license, isn't it? How much game are you allowed to bag with that license? Mr. Bond, I think you're the man to help me save planet Earth. Will you do that? Will you join forces with me? And Bond says, you're right, I will. And I said, and you know, people are sitting there in this room going like that. And I said, here's the thing. People who are really smart will know that he's not going to do it. And they'll go, I knew he wouldn't do it. And people who thought he was going to do it will simply be surprised when he doesn't do it. So you can't lose. Mm-hmm. And that was my idea. That was my contribution. And I went back to the Dorchester Hotel thinking what a genius I was. The next day I came back, and it was gone. It was off the table. I said, but why? Because it's everything you said. It's nothing that had been done before, and it was simple. And they said, it's too real. It's too serious.
That's crazy. And you would think only a few years later with the Daniel Craig films and previously the Timothy Dalton films, that would have been something they would have lapped up and would have been kind of the core of the film.
I was in the wrong place at the wrong time.
It's answered one of the questions I've always had in the back of my mind and stuff. So thank you for telling me that. I suppose it's crazy to think that you've got Holmes, Spock, Kirk, James Bond, that's quite the portfolio you've got under your belt with them alone.
Yeah, well, Don't want to leave out H.G. Wells and Jack the Ripper.
Of course.
Yeah, there's a few others.
Obviously, you have the kind of, the nation is gripped at the moment, sort of with the coronavirus and lockdowns. And it, obviously, I can see the sort of the parallels between sort of the day after. Obviously, that was about the devastation caused by nuclear war. Is it always amazed you that sort of the day after continues to seem relevant every single decade and so on, that it truly is kind of a bit of a timeless piece of material?
It's probably the most worthwhile thing I ever got to do with my life, because for those of your listeners who are unfamiliar, it's a movie. It was the most watched movie ever made for television, and like Threads and like Testament, and it's a movie, television movie about nuclear war between the United States and the Soviet Union, in which everybody dies. But it's not told from the point of view of Washington or the military or politicians. It's just about people living in Kansas and how they are affected by it. And it was sufficiently disturbing to Ronald Reagan, who was then the president of the United States, that he wound up going to Reykjavik, Iceland, and signing the Intermediate Range Weapons Treaty with Mikhail Gorbachev, that same treaty that our current president, Donald Trump, has just decided in his infinite wisdom to abandon. Yes, it is more relevant now than it was when it came out. We all thought, you know, with the collapse of the Soviet Union, that things would get better. But we didn't, you know, realize that they were about to get much worse. And it's a very terrifying world from every standpoint in which we all find ourselves now. As I say, it was probably the most worthwhile thing I got to do with my life to date. I'm still hoping to do something worthwhile. What was your other question?
And finally, one of the books that I think has been most important to me that you've written was your book, A View from the Bridge, about your career in TV, film, and writing. And it's kind of one of my favorite nonfiction books. How important is it for you to share your experiences and insights with a new generation of writers, filmmakers, and people that are looking to make their way there? How important is that for you to do things, whether it's this podcast, you know, those kind of books to spread that kind of knowledge?
Well, in my life, I have done and do a fair amount of teaching. I had a friend once said to me, before you are anything else, you are a teacher. I venerate teachers. I certainly was shaped by wonderful teachers. And there is a tradition, I suppose, of give back, that of sharing, of passing on knowledge, you know, not always factual knowledge, but experience. I happen to be an enormous fan of Stephen Sondheim. I think Stephen Sondheim is sort of the Mozart of now. And Stephen Sondheim wrote two books. One called Finishing the Hat, and the second one called Look, I Made a Hat. And they are books about his experiences writing musicals and writing for musical theater, whether you're talking about Sweeney Todd, West Side Story, A Little Night Music, A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum, Pacific Overtures. And I read these books. I'm reading them now. I've always meant to read them, and now I have time to read them. And what these books are doing is teaching me how to think. They're not teaching me what to think about. That's still up to me. But they are a good and rigorous and inspiring training for the mind, for the intellectual process, which is exciting because it's fun to learn stuff. And I think that part of the reason that I wrote my memoir was very similar for why Sondheim has written these books. It's the teaching impulse. And as I say, not telling you what to think, but trying to help you think, train you to think by exposing you to the thought processes of other people. And God knows I'm learning a lot from reading these Sondheim books. I can't recommend them enough. I mean, all the lyrics are in there. And you can read the lyrics or not. But it's his commentaries about lyric writing and where it wanders off into other subjects. What's the difference between poetry and poetic? What is the difference between real and realism and so forth? You learn a lot and you find yourself thinking hard. And I enjoy that. Especially when I'm cooped up.
Well, thank you so much, Nicholas, for joining me. It's been an absolute honor to talk with you today and learn more about your craft. So I wish you and your family all the best health and stuff just now. And thank you so much, and good luck with all the books and films and TV still to come.
Stay safe.
Join the revolution. Join the Nerd Party.
Welcome to Nerd Party.